Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, August 1st, and today's session is Manna and Mercy, Flying Through the Bible, Session 4, God's Surprise. It is presented by Dan Erlander, and it is number ERD 2002-17.
Today we are going to move into the life and death and resurrection of Jesus as part of the whole story. And now the tape may begin, and this is Dan Erlander, and this is our fourth class, and today is the title is God's Surprise. For us centering today, part of our story as we move really through Luke's gospel, the devil chooses is the one dying on the cross who says, "Jesus, remember me." And for our kind of opening and settling, let's sing that Tise together.
Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom.
Today we move into the New Testament, and I would begin with this saying: if this idea is still held anyplace, I would like to counter it, and that is that the God of the Old Testament is a God of vengeance and of judgment, and the God of the New Testament is the God of grace and mercy. And whenever I hear that, I want to read the Ananias and Sapphira story in the book of Acts. And part of writing Manna and Mercy was to give this sense that this is one book, and this is one story. To show how this still prevails in our culture, I copied this cartoon out of the New Yorker and it's a man who has died, and you can't see this, but he's coming up through the clouds, and here's St. Peter at his little, it's always like in a restaurant, you know, the little maitre d' stand. And St. Peter is saying, "Bad timing. He's in one of his Old Testament moods today." Today, in looking at Jesus and his restoration of man as society in wilderness and early Israel, we're going to see how it's one story. The other thing I wanted to mention from yesterday, when I was in Isaiah 40 to 55, and I'm sure you recognize my quoting from the servant passages in Isaiah. You know, he was wounded for our transgressions, bruised for our iniquities. And one reason for putting it in that setting of the exile is the reminder that it's important for Christians to read these passages first of all, from a Jewish standpoint, and for the people of Israel who lived with these beautiful words for hundreds of years before Jesus came, and the suffering servant, sometimes it's an individual, sometimes it seems to be the nation, and most Jewish people understood it, that the suffering of their nation was the suffering servant, and this is still the primary. I used to think, well, if only Jews would read that passage, they'd become Christians. But you realize how precious this has been. But then for us who are Christians, we see this beautiful fulfillment, or Jesus really taking on the role of the suffering servant. The other thing is, we moved yesterday rather quickly through the intertestamental period, and this is a part we don't study very much because there's a gap in the middle of the Protestant Bible. The books that cover this era, I can never quite say it, it's on my cover, with the apocryphal deuterocanonical books. But to know this, in studying the Gospels, so much is helpful to understand this era and to the time of Jesus. Just for some examples, the heirs of the Maccabean power, which I think were called the Seleucids, those families, who became the priests and literally ran the priests out of the temple, that many of those priests went out to the desert and became the core of the Essene community. And then the priests then that took power, which we meet in the New Testament as Caiaphas and Annas, and these would be the heirs of these, I just call them fake priests who ordained themselves, very corrupt. And their party we meet in the New Testament as the Sadducees. And then, so these are, they're just two examples of how it helps to know this period. The other is the time of Jesus. There was an overwhelming war consciousness among the people, you know, waiting for the big battle to throw the Romans out of the country. And they had their inspiration from possibly their, I don't know if it would be great-grandparents or great-great-grandparents, who would have fought with the Maccabean armies that threw the Greeks out of the country, which gave them their inspiration. We can do the same with the Romans. And this is why in Jesus' time you have the beginning of the what eventually become the armies of, help me with the word, the guerrilla soldiers.
Zealots.
Yeah, thank you. Zealots. And we think that at the time of Jesus they were more bandit groups, and zealots really formed in the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, up until the great Jewish-Roman War that ended in 70 AD with the fall of Jerusalem. Now, we moved right yesterday, right up to the dawn, or the before now the birth of Jesus. And now, under the Roman Empire, as you remember yesterday, I said the Jewish people fell into the Roman Empire not by so much a military defeat, but more like rotten fruit falling off a tree into the arms of the Roman Empire. Which was very happy to take them over. And now what happens really is a new kind of Pharaoh's Egypt under the harsh and cruel oppression of Rome. And a little later I'll get into the context. But in this situation, the people cry out again. They cry out again in their oppression as the slaves cried out in Egypt. Those who cried out sometimes are called the Anawim, the poor of the land who really had no power to do anything else but to cry to God for mercy and for help. And to again picture God as hearing the cries of the oppressed, of the people that God loves so deeply. And now, hearing the cry, God decides to act, but it acts in a way that no human committee would have ever thought of. In fact, I like to think the angels and all the saints and everyone in the heavenly realms was totally surprised by what God did. Finds a young, poor, Anawim peasant, woman, teenager. Her name is Miriam. Later, Greek, it's Jesus. Mary. Get Jesus and his mother mixed up. Reminds me of, this is in John, you know, when Jesus was saying to them, the one without sin cast the first stone. And so, and they all dropped their stones, and Jesus was kind of proud, and then his stone flew over his head, and he looked back and said, "Mother, stay out of this." Her name is Mary, and an angel appears to her and announces to her that she will be the mother of the Messiah, the Liberator. And then the Spirit of God breathes into the womb of Mary. And now to the Jewish people, the image would be clear. Back to Genesis 1:1-2, of the Spirit of God or the breath of God hovering over the deep and the chaos and the darkness. And then that wind of God bringing forth the creation. And now that same wind of God now blows and hovers over the deep and the dark of Mary's womb to bring forth a whole new creation. And in the birth narrative, Luke has a beautiful picture to announce that this is a new creation by bringing the angel choir. Now, what the angel choir was a group of angels that had been practicing their anthems for a long time. Because in the book of Job, we have the angels singing at creation. So this choir sang at the creation of the heavens and the earth. And now after a very long practice, they're singing again. They're singing again. And one symbolism of this is, here is another new creation. So with Mary and in Mary, Yahweh forms a new creation. And then Mary sings her song. My soul magnifies the Lord, and my spirit rejoices in God my Savior, who has looked with favor on God's lowly servant. Surely from now on all generations will call me blessed. For you, the Mighty One, has done great things for me. Holy is your name. Your mercy is on those who fear you from generation to generation. You have shown strength with your arm, scattered the proud in the thoughts of their hearts, brought down the powerful from their thrones, lifted up the lowly, and you have filled the hungry with good things and sent the rich empty away. You have helped your servant Israel in remembrance of your mercy, according to the promise you made to our ancestors, to Abraham and Sarah, and to their descendants forever. This is the language of revolution. So, thrown down the mighty from their seats. This is revolution. And then filled the hungry with good things and sent the rich, and they knew who this was. It was the Roman hierarchy, the Roman elites, the Sadducees, the Jewish priestly classes that were taking advantage of them. And Mary is so certain this has happened that she doesn't even sing this in the future tense. What trust that God will work God's miracle. Now, how does this revolution happen? Because we, with our human minds and our human committees, understand the way it works is that the poor people gain enough power to overthrow the rich people, and then they become the big deals, and they find somebody else to exploit, who eventually forms an army to overthrow them. This is the way we assume this works, but just wait. God has a surprise. Mary with Joseph in Bethlehem gives birth, lodged in a stable. And she holds her baby, weak and vulnerable, wet, crying. God's surprise. God's way of bringing mishpat, justice and life and liberation. What could be more vulnerable? What could be more weak than a newborn baby in a barn? Let's sing.
Away in a manger, in a crib for a bed, the little Lord Jesus lay down his sweet head. The stars in the sky looked down where he lay. The
Jesus in the manger, what kind of a world is it to which he comes? Sometimes our image of this world comes from the pictures that were hanging on the walls in Sunday school. Especially maybe Jesus and the children. And here's a Jesus in a white robe, and then on his lap and around him are rosy-cheeked children. Happy, and then parents smiling, and then flowers around them, and then maybe sometimes the pictures showed one or two crabby disciples. Didn't like what was going on. But pretty much I remember these pictures that it just seemed like a rather serene time, a wonderful time to bring your children to Jesus, to have Jesus bless them. But rather, when you understand the context of these times, it was a time of great upheaval, great hunger, poverty, and it was a time when the intensity of oppression of the Roman occupation was pushing on the people. It was a time when Greek culture was invading, predominated the ancient world. From Nazareth, you could see across to the great Greek-Roman city, Sepphora, which became a center of Greek culture. By the way, when you think of the power of empire to take over cultures, it always reminds me of reading what the most watched television show on Earth is, and it's Baywatch. And this is what we call a cultural invasion. And that was happening. Greek, and then it's not true. I grew up on California beaches. It never looked like that. Massive economic and social upheaval that was caused by the Roman occupation, the Roman elites in collaboration with the Jewish elites down in Jerusalem. And they collaborated in this way with heavy Roman taxation that had increased since the time of Caesar or Herod the Great. Now it was Herod Antipas, because now the administration of Galilee was much closer to where the Galilean people lived. And Herod Antipas wanted to build a lot of fancy cities and buildings. And one thing is, you never tax the rich. You tax the poor, the peasants. And so the Roman taxation was raised, and this was taxation in kind for the peasant farmer. And it would grow every year, which means that every year it would be hard to have enough left at the end of the year to buy seeds to plant the next year's crop or other ways of going into debt. But added to that, the priestly classes in Jerusalem started adding to the temple tithe, which was a matter of obedience to God. And some estimates, by the time of the ministry of Jesus, the temple tithe that you were required to pay was up to 20% of your crops. The Roman taxation, maybe 30% of your crops. Then you had other taxes like toll taxes when you were traveling, and other ways that this was pushing the people in desperate poverty, which probably was very intentional, because by pushing the peasant people into debt and more debt, they eventually lose their land. And then who takes the land over? Herod Antipas had a massive estate in Galilee. Temple elites down in Jerusalem had estates where they had taken over the land from the peasants, the Nahala. And why do we have so many stories in the New Testament about absent landowners and stewards and day laborers? Because now as you lose your land, then you either become a tenant farmer, or now the owner, the landowner again, takes rent in kind. So you have that plus your temple tithe plus other Roman taxes. And then if you are in worse shape, you become a day laborer. If you don't have work one day, your family does not eat the next day. And in this desperation, many families choose not to pay the temple tithe so they can keep their family together, because this is breaking families up, young people going to the cities to find work, and then also some of the children of these families going into the hills to join the bandit groups that sweep down, and if there's a small enough Roman garrison, they will kill them, but more likely they sweep into the homes and palatial homes of the rich and sweep in and kill the family. So these are desperate times. And some have said that if you were there, it would not be like dying children that we see pictures from Africa, but there would be a sense of hunger among the children and the families. Now, if you chose not to pay the temple tithe to keep your family together, then you were labeled a sinner. And then the way that your neighbors who were still paying the tithe would treat you, you would be called a sinner. And therefore, no one then was allowed to share food with you, because one does not eat with sinners. So you had a choice between even more desperate poverty or being treated as an outcast and as a sinner in your religious community. And the worst thing that could happen is if the father, because of the deep, deep debt, would be thrown into debtor's prison. And then the family would have to try to raise the money to buy the father out of prison. And possibly, you know, Jesus, the friend of the prostitute, possibly some of them were wives who had reached this point of oppression in order to gain enough money to buy a husband out of prison. So these were not normal times. And the messianic expectations were intense. When things are this bad, the Messiah must come. And then there's out on the desert, the wilderness, John the Baptist, and people are streaming out to him. Something's happening in the midst of this terror. And there in the wilderness they go, and John the Baptist invites them into the Jordan River to be baptized. Symbolism. Ah, it's time to go back to Egypt and then go through the Red Sea, or to name that you are in Pharaoh's Egypt, and then to go through the sea again and start all over. And then in the wilderness, what does God do in wildernesses? This will be on the final exam. Sets up a school. And John the Baptist is a teacher now. And they say to the teacher, "What then shall we do?" Someone asked me that once after a sermon, and I fainted. Doesn't happen very often. they say to John, "What then shall we do?" And his response, "If you have two coats, give one to someone who has none. Food hoarders, do the same. Soldiers, stop robbing people." It's the restoration of the manna society of the wilderness, where your possessions and your food is your manna. And we're going to be ready for the Messiah by living again the way of the wilderness. Jesus comes to John and goes into the water, which is really his ordination into his ministry, and then into the wilderness, the desert, where he is tempted by the devil. And this one picture from Man in Mercy, it's one of my favorites, so I'm going to turn this. Can you see it? So the Satan is the Messiah success seminar teacher. And he says, if you want to succeed as a Messiah, I would suggest that you follow plan A. And plan A is all the things you have in the temptation of Jesus. And then plan B is really from 2 Isaiah 40 to 55. Vulnerable love and compassion, live and teach dignity and mercy and food for all, get in trouble and die on a cross, and then trust God for your vindication. And Jesus chooses plan B and enters the synagogue at Nazareth, and there his inaugural address as the Messiah. Good news to the poor, reading from Isaiah, liberty to captives, sight to the blind, freedom to the oppressed. Now, I have a friend who teaches New Testament at PLU, and his field of study is the sociology and economics of the Galilean peasant. So when I want to know something more about the Galilean peasant, I call Doug Oakman. And one thing he told me that we don't deeply understand the ministry of Jesus in Galilee unless we understand that Jesus saw Galilee as a new Pharaoh's Egypt. And then in Nazareth, the synagogue sermon of Jesus is that into Pharaoh's Egypt, Galilee, he announces a new day. And it's a day of good news to the poor. And what else could that mean but, wow, land, lower taxes. You know, we can live again as a family and the others. And finally, he announces a year of the Lord's favor. And there's almost unanimous of Bible scholars that this is a code word for Jubilee. In my coming in Galilee, Jubilee is going to happen. And in the little cartoon in Manna and Mercy, there's two hearers whispering to each other, and the one says, "Sounds like land reform." This is the acceptable year of the Lord. My coming is the blowing of the Jubilee horn. And again, there'll be abundance for all. Now hold that. Politicians sometimes don't keep their promises. Sorry to tell you that. Does Jesus keep the promise of Jubilee? Now, empowered by the Holy Spirit, Jesus goes forth, preaching the good news and preaching a restored society. Man is sharing, mercy sharing, and a renewal of ancient Israel, and a renewal of the wilderness life. Healing, casting out demons, teaching, forgiving, storytelling, and eating, and then eating, and then eating, and then eating some more, accepting hospitality, receiving hospitality, inviting others, calling the rich to invite the poor, the maimed, the lame, and the blind, and then eating some more and eating some more until he's called a glutton and a drunkard. And so doing, he portrays the reign of God. He portrays a new wilderness society in the feeding of the 5,000. Here's manna that's falling, and there's enough for everyone, and everyone receives, and no one goes around to the crowds finding out who's worthy and who's not, or who hasn't taken the classes yet to understand. But the feeding of the 5,000 is a new wilderness. And then in a society that is neatly defined by who is worthy and who is not worthy, who is in, who is out, who is righteous, who is a sinner, he goes forth and forgives the sinners, eats with the tax collectors and the sinners. He eats with the unworthy, and then he gathers a community and then teaches this community that this community is the beginning of a renewal of primitive Israel, early Israel, when there was no king. but only God was king. And in the teaching of Jesus, the code word for king is patron, a patron or father. Call no one on earth your father, because we're going back to primitive Israel. There's only one father, and that means we are all equal. Fascinating when Peter comes and says, look, we've given up our mothers, fathers, and our houses and everything else for you. Jesus comes back and tells them, in my kingdom, when you come into my kingdom, and you will be given in return mothers and sisters and brothers and houses and persecutions. And what word does Jesus leave out? Fathers. And then when he says, who is my mother and who is my sister and who is my brother, whom does Jesus leave out? Fathers, because that was a code word for king or patron. And in my new community, there will be no patrons, which in the society of Jesus and in the Roman Empire, it was set up on a very complicated patronage system, which we don't experience anywhere except in the mountains of New Mexico. When we lived there in the old Spanish, there's still a patron system. But it's where you have a boss, and then under the boss you have others, and then they are clients, and then these clients of this patron are the patrons of people under them. And it's a very complicated order. And maybe why was Jesus' family so upset with him and thought he was crazy? He had the perfect opportunity to set up an office and an administrative center. And there he could be the patron, and his family then would be the gatekeepers. They would be those out in the front office deciding who can come in to the patron Messiah, Jesus. But instead, Jesus wanders from place to place, and he will never be a patron. For only God is the patron. Now, then in the teaching of Jesus and the inviting of the poor, the maimed, the lame, and the blind, his receiving of hospitality and his prayer, the center of the prayer he gives his disciples is manna sharing and debt forgiving. Food sharing and debt forgiving. That, along with hallowing the name of God, will be the characteristic of Jesus' new society. The powers and the big deals and the religious leaders and those who are in collaboration with Rome are deeply disturbed. This is a dangerous threat to the way things are. And now Jesus sets his face to go to Jerusalem to confront these powers. And on his way to Jerusalem, stops in Jericho, and he looks up into a tree and sees this little man. And Jesus acts in a way. He tells this man up in the tree, if you promise to shape up your life a little, if you make promises that you're going to improve, then I might come to your house. Is that the right translation? Zacchaeus, I'm going to your house. Zacchaeus was the worst of the manna hoarders and bandit administrators in the Roman tax system. Zacchaeus, rich. And Jesus says, I'm going to your house. Now, Shall we sing it? Some of you remember.
Zacchaeus was a wee little man, a wee little man was he. He climbed up in a sycamore tree, for the Lord he wanted to see.
Someone from Britain was there and said, there they sing it, for I'm going to your house for tea. Which is closer, because to go to a house, it would be inconceivable to go to a house without meal sharing. Yeah. Now, notice in Sunday school the part of the story that is left out. And that is that Zacchaeus is so overcome by unconditional love and grace and mercy of this prophet, this rabbi, who has come to his house and by eating with him has announced to him that you are my beloved brother. And if Mrs. Zacchaeus was there, and if you look in Man and Mercy, she has really big eyelashes. If Mrs. Zacchaeus is there, it's, you are my sister. You are my sister. And now here comes Mary's revolution from the Magnificat. The rich, and the despised rich, but the rich now start the revolution themselves by lowering themselves. And Zacchaeus jumps up and he can't wait to start a wilderness manna redistribution program. He says, half of all my possessions I will give to the poor. And if I have cheated anyone, and there's people looking through the windows and their eyeballs are rolling, if I have cheated anyone, I will repay them four times. Now this part is left out of the Sunday school lessons, because we like to hear about the grace and the love of Jesus. But we're uncomfortable with this kind of response. My goodness. And now I have a friend, Charlie Mays, who sometimes I'm called Dan the Bible Man. Charlie studies the Bible much more than I do. And he told me once, Zacchaeus is just before Jesus goes to Jerusalem there to suffer and die. There's one parable in between. And Charlie said, I really think that Luke put this story here to tell us why Jesus went to Jerusalem to die. And that is to create a Zacchaeus world of Mishpat. So Jesus goes to Jerusalem. By the way, before Jesus says, today salvation has come to this house, for this man is also a son of Abraham, am I right? Which is saying he has been cast out because of his sinfulness, and now salvation has come to him. And I love the most ancient meaning of the word salvation. It means space, spaciousness. Freedom from oppression, freedom from guilt, spaciousness. So if someone asks you, are you saved? In your baptism, your response can be, I am spacious. Try that and give me a report. Um, Jesus in Jerusalem and the intensity of the debate and the enmity with the leaders. The leaders, the rich, the Pharisees, the upper people, the religious enforcers, etc., etc. The tension mounts. All of those who are benefiting from the system as it is now gather together. How can we destroy him? Passover meal with his disciples, again, a wilderness meal that they share. Do this to remember me. Then Gethsemane, his arrest, Judas kisses him. The temple police, the chief priests, the elders arrest him. And why? Their world of some is threatened by his word of all. Do you get it? Their world that is centered on the word S-O-M-E is threatened by his world that is centered in A-L-L. And once I said A-A-L. Sometimes I've taken along a box of all detergent. Just every time you walk down the aisle of the grocery store and see all, I'm not recommending that you buy this particular brand. But look at that word and say, this is Jesus who came. But God loves not some, but all. They try him, they condemn him. The wails of God fill the universe. Creation weeps. God is in Christ reconciling the world to God's self. Yahweh and Jesus bear the pain of the world, absorbing the arrogance, the hatred, and the violence of the big deals. And then there on the cross, Jesus offers manna and mercy. Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they are doing. From the cross, all your debts are canceled. And then to the other on the cross, who says, Jesus, remember me. Today you will be with me in paradise. And no Jewish person would think of paradise without thinking of the biggest, most sumptuous spread that you've ever seen on a major cruise ship. You get the picture? This is paradise. And here Jesus is saying to this thief, very likely one of the sons of a family that had joined a bandit group, and saying to him, this very day we are going to be sharing meal in God's paradise. And the fruit of this innocent suffering. Remember how Isaiah 40 to 55, the servant song. He will not give up until he has established justice, mishpat. Remember the dream of the prophets that the nations will come streaming to Zion, saying, teach us the way of your God. Well, the first one comes, and it's the centurion soldier who was in charge of the crucifixion and looks at this innocent, suffering love and a person who keeps trust in God and trusts God to vindicate, says, truly, truly, this man is innocent. Or in Matthew and Mark, it's truly this is the Son of God. The first of the nations comes to the cross. But after the death of Jesus, now the big deals, those who benefit from the system, are very happy. In fact, in the book I had, they're having a cocktail party. And they're saying to each other, everything is back to normal. Thank God, everything is back to normal. Because those in power have voted. And they have voted no to Jesus. By his death on the cross, they have voted no to his way of enemy love, no to his way of forgiving debts, no to his way of eating and receiving with sinners and receiving sinners. They have said no, no to his mercy for all, no to his proclamation of the reign of God, no to the restoration of early Israel, the wilderness society, no. And the vote has been taken, and Jesus is dead. But one vote has not been taken, and that is the vote of Yahweh Sabaoth, who reaches into that tomb and says yes, and votes yes. Yes to his way of enemy love and teaching and sharing and forgiving and welcoming the reign of God. And God vindicates Jesus by the resurrection. And now this is life. This is shalom. This is the way of peace. And nothing will be normal again. And now, oh, I'm sorry. It's almost coffee. But I'd like to tell about Jesus. Yeah, let's have some responses quickly.
Dan, I love the hall image, and I'll remember that when I go to the grocery store. And I was reminded, and I think you implied this, that the all includes not just people, but it's all of creation.
Yeah.
And like in John, where Jesus says, when I am lifted up, I will draw everything to myself, not just people.
Pantone, yeah. Isn't the Greek word. And I forgot to mention this, and with Norm here and his teaching, you know, I say, why do I forget that the story of the crucifixion has has nature involved in the weeping. Nature wrenched by an earthquake. And in Man and Mercy, I have animals weeping and trees bending over. That we say the death on the cross is for the mending of the entire universe, starting with the biggest problem, humans. Yeah, that's some thanks, man.
Can I ask a question?
Is there a question? Oh, right here. Have I been... Have you felt like I've gone back to you?
How did Zacchaeus, for Zacchaeus to be so transformed in the presence of Jesus, he had to assume that Jesus had a whole lot of authority to give pardon and to be this giver of a new way of life. How did that get manifest in Jesus? How did people give him that authority?
Mm-hmm.
Because he didn't, in a way, go around the mansion.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So how do you think people perceived who he was, that their life would be so transformed by him before the crucifixion event?
Yeah.
I think our Christianity depends on reading back through Easter and the cross and then mm-hmm. the ministry of Jesus.
Yeah.
But they didn't have that benefit.
Yeah, my my picture of that would be Mahatma Gandhi was never elected to any office. He never held any position of authority in any government. And yet, do you remember in the movie when there was this angry mob and Gandhi walked right into the angry mob and there was this sense of power and authority that they all just quietly moved away, which might have been the same sense in Nazareth, you know, when they sought to throw him off the cliff and it said Jesus walked through them and went on his way. You know, that they're in part of those who take nonviolent training, much of it is a discipline of prayer, so that you can move into the world with this sense of a vulnerable empowerment. And I really think that was the power that Jesus had. And I've seen it in stories of nonviolent resistance, where people fully armed just melt before always doesn't work, but before this power of nonviolent love. And we're up here.
Dan, going back to what's in the beginning about the Old Testament God and the New Testament God, why do you think it's been so handy for the church to juxtapose, you know, God of vengeance, that God, and our God? Has it been a sociological racist thing against Judaism? Has it been a handy theological tool in this begotten? And why has that been so much a part of the way we told our stories, making it their story?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know. I think it's part of the history of anti-Semitism. The pro-Nazi German Christians, the one of the early things they did was throw out most of the Old Testament, except for like the 23rd Psalm. I wonder if it was because anti-Semitism or anti-Jewish started very, very early. And then Marcion, the early Christian teacher who taught that they were actually two separate gods. Fortunately, he was declared a heretic. But that they were actually two separate gods, the God of evil judgment and vengeance and the God of grace and love. Probably other reasons, but that's anybody else.
I just love the way you make the connections between the manna and the Eucharist.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
One meal.
Yeah, it's one meal. Yeah. Yeah, here.
I'm really drawn to the all image in the Jesus, including the welcoming all people, and yet I still struggle with a few of the verses where there, it doesn't always seem to be all, where many are called, the few are chosen, or the narrow road. Mm-hmm. Or the Canaanite woman who doesn't get the food until she begs to Jesus, even they get the scraps, the donkey would get the scraps. Mm-hmm. So there are some verses in the Bible that seem to indicate not always all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Or when Jesus.
What do you do with those verses, even though I'm drawn to the all ones?
I guess the way I would respond to that one would be like the rich man who left and Jesus looked at him and loved him. Especially in Matthew, there's a real division between those who receive Jesus and those who don't. What we're saying here about Jesus, that he loves all of them, and especially he loves those who don't love Jesus, who make the decision on whom should be loved. There is this division, but it is not the division of the love of God.
Would you say that again?
Oh, yeah. say I don't understand. We struggle with it because there is the people that are out, you know, and but here maybe this is the clearest way. The reason they are out is because they don't want to be in a group that is for all. The, another way, Capon, the writer, said that his definition of hell is this small area where all the party poopers go that don't want to be part of the party. Does that make sense? And if I could close with this, you know, I was touched, you know, when we had the video the other day of Muhammad. Because he too brought to the world in a world where there were fighting clans and hatred, a community that could be for all people. You know that there's a real parallel there. So, yeah. Well.
Thank you.
Tomorrow we'll do the early church and the whole book of Revelation, and then I want to make that short so we have more time to discuss.